Hello and welcome back to the Dive and Dig podcast news series. My name's Lucy Blue and I represent the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeological research in the Eastern Mediterranean. However, this week we're not going to leave the shores of the United Kingdom. I'm going to be talking to a long-term colleague and friend of mine, Mark Beattie Edwards, who heads up the Nautical Archaeology Society. And they've been working on a very interesting wreck that was discovered some time ago, but only very recently recognised as an important 17th century Dutch vessel. It's really nice to talk with you. Thank you very much. Do you want to just briefly introduce yourself and the society? That would be an excellent place to start, please.
Sure thing, Lucy. My name is Mark Beattie Edwards. I currently work as the Chief Executive Officer at the Nautical Archaeology Society, which as a day job means I'm running a charity. But as well as that, I do get to run investigations on particularly shipwreck sites, which is my thing, of which this shipwreck is just one exciting new example.
No, absolutely. I mean, I have to admit that I'm not as familiar with this. I think it's called the Klein Hollandia, if I'm correct, and it's dating from the 17th century, and it has had quite a lot of publicity, which is amazing. It's always good for archaeology to get publicity. But could you just tell me a little bit more about where it is and why it's received such visibility?
The wreck is located 7.3 nautical miles, being exact, southeast of Beachy Head, the big sort of landmark cliffs on the south coast of England in the English Channel. And it was, well, it was originally found in 2019 by the recreational divers following up a survey that was undertaken by the Hydrographic Office in 2015. But the reason why it's received publicity most recently, this year in the January of 2023, was that we were joined by a film team from Digging for Britain, the series that goes out on the BBC. They came to visit the site with us last year. And we held off all the press activity to when the programme went live on the BBC. So it was followed up by the press all over the world. So we were really astounded by how much publicity it was receiving.
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant, though, because, I mean, that's what we want, isn't it, as maritime archaeologists, to grab people's attention and get them excited about what we find underwater and what we do underwater. And so presumably there was a reason why the BBC decided to come and visit your site. What's so special about Klein Hollandia that has grabbed everybody's imagination and all this media attention?
That's a good question. I often get asked about what's so special about this site, and in British history, I suppose, you know, it's a tiny little part of the 17th century. But what we discovered when the identification was confirmed, you know, as close to 100% as we can be that it's confirmed as the Klein Hollandia, was that actually our knowledge of what was happening in England at the time, and the Second Anglo-Dutch War and the Third Anglo-Dutch War, was actually really quite small. I mean, you could find hardly anything. Not much had been written about. There wasn't much online about it. So the discovery of this site has helped us illuminate that part of history. And what's cool, what I really love about this, is that it's a single ship that sinks in an engagement that leads to a war being officially declared. So we end up going back to war against the Dutch in 1672 because of this engagement that this ship sinks in. And it's the only ship that sinks in this engagement. So that's why we're pretty confident that it is actually the Klein Hollandia.
Oh. So after the initial discovery then, it was identified as a ship, but they didn't know exactly which ship it was. Is that what you're indicating?
The way the timeline of the investigation has worked is that the UK Hydrographic Office surveyed an anomaly, a lump and a bump, on the seabed at that location in 2015. But it doesn't get uploaded to the public record. It's not put into the public domain until early 2016. And the local dive boat skipper, Dave Ronan, who runs a dive boat out of Eastbourne, he noticed it appear on his charts in 2016 and thought, well, We'll go and dive that one day. They bought their boat so they could find new things, not just about taking punters onto you know, the old favourite wrecks. So they put it into their plotters and said, well, we'll go and dive it sometime. But it actually takes them until 2019 to get round to it. So we lose years before they actually dive it in 2019. Now, I've known Dave and I've worked with Dave, the boat skipper, for probably a decade now on other protected sites, the Holland V submarine, the Norman's Bay wreck, which is also a Dutch 17th century ship. And so I suppose I was the logical person for him to phone when his divers came to the surface and went, I think you might have just found something that's quite old. So I suppose it was logical that Dave was going to phone me. So I get an answer machine message on my mobile phone. I was out of the country at the time and I pick up the message and it's Dave going, I think you're going to want to come and dive on this. and this was in April of 2019. And actually we had already booked to dive with Dave on the last weekend in April of that year. So that we only had to wait about 7 days before we got to get to go and dive it. So we're pretty confident we did the second dive on the site. Pretty much in 2019. So we've been diving it ever since. So for 4 years now, we're into our fifth season of diving on the site. And we've done, in total, there have been 45 visits, which considering there's been a pandemic and lockdowns during that time, 45 visits over the 4 years is pretty good.
No, absolutely, especially over that period of time. But so how did you move from, okay, there's obviously, I assume, there's going to be remains on the seabed that give you an indication of the rough date. But how did you actually get to the point of thinking, right, this is this specific wreck, this is the Klein Hollandia?
What's special about the site in terms of diving it and the assemblage on the seabed, and it's something that I'd never seen in over 25 years of doing this, are the bronze cannon that lie just flat, lying around, scattered over the site. And some of them are upside down, but some of them are the right way up. So the right way being that their lifting dolphins are visible and any markings along the tops are visible, because often they don't get marked on the undersides, they're marked on the tops. So even from that very first dive that we did, the second dive ever on the site, we think, in April 2019, one of those guns, which unimaginatively is called gun number one, actually had a name on it, so we could brush our hand to clear away some of the marine growth over it, and we could see a name written on the back, on the base ring, on the back of the gun, and that name was somebody called Cornelis Uderog. So we literally just filmed it and wrote down the name as we were reading the letters, made sure that we had it on camera as well, and got to the surface. And it sounds very unscientific, but we literally just did some Googling. We Googled the name Cornelis Uderog. And it turns out that actually Cornelis Uderog was a gun founder that was making cannons for the Dutch admiralties, particularly the Admiralty of Rotterdam. So from that second dive ever on site, we were pretty confident it was Dutch. And we actually reached out to the Dutch immediately and asked them for some advice and input and help with the research. So that's how we end up with it being a Dutch ship. Mm. How we end up narrowing it down to the Klein Hollandia is also guns, but also the rest of the assemblage. One of the guns has a date. So we have 1670. So we know that our gun was made in 1670. So our site has to be sometime after that, of course. But the rest of the assemblage is a bit weird. Because...
What do you mean by weird?
Well, it's a military vessel. So we've got 32 cannons on the seabed. Bronze ones made for the Admiralty of Rotterdam. So it's a military ship, an armed military ship. So that's fine, and that fits with the Klein Hollandia. But we've also got a cargo on the ship. So it's carrying trade goods as well. It's not just ballast stones. We've actually got 3.75-metre long blocks of stone that look like they could be made into columns or structural pieces of architecture. We've also got slabs of tiles, marble tiles that come from the Italian Alps, Apuan Alps near Carrara marble, Carrara in Italy. And there are hundreds of these things on the seabed. We've got...
It's really weird though, isn't it? That's really odd to have. So what was going on?
It's it's odd to see them together on the seabed, but it's really helpful because actually, if it were without that cargo, we would just have a military ship, and we'd then be looking at military ships that sank after 1670 from the Dutch, and that would be loads of them. Or if we didn't have the guns, but we just had the cargo, we'd be looking for merchant ships that probably come from Italy, because we've got the Italian marble and we've also got some Italian pottery, fine ceramic wares on the site. So it'd be quite difficult to narrow it down, because I don't know how we actually work out exactly which one it was. But in this instance, because we've got both together in one location, we're either looking at, and this is unlikely, two ships of differing times that are landed on top of each other in exactly the right location, or one ship that fits the bill of being of Dutch nationality, but of coming back from Italy, carrying cargo as part of a convoy escorted by the military, which is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, because we can literally in 1672, 2 years after the gun was made, a ship from the right Admiralty that this gun comes from, the Admiralty of Rotterdam, was coming back from Italy, escorting a convoy, including coming back from Carrera, the ports Genoa and Lenovo that are near the Carrera marble quarries, coming back to bring all this trade goods back to the Netherlands. So, and what, as I said earlier, what's brilliant is that the Klein Hollandia is the only ship that sinks. So we don't have an engagement where four or five vessels sink and we've got to work out which one is it, and maybe we'll never know which one it is. Actually, the historical accounts tell us that only one ship sinks. So we can pretty much put our finger on that one being the Klein Hollandia.
That's amazing, really. I mean, you couldn't write it, really, could you? I mean, it's that combination of pieces of evidence to put together, if you sort of, I mean, rarely, as we know, rarely happen for archaeologists to be able to nail it so precisely. And that's just fantastic. I think that answers my first question about why is this so important, actually.
It's the first time it's happened to me. We've worked on the Normans Bay wreck for over 10 years, since 2011, actually, we started diving on the Normans Bay wreck, which is in the vicinity, in Pevensey Bay, off of near Eastbourne, off the Sussex coast. And there, we think it's the Weppen van Utrecht, a warship that sank in the Battle of Beachy Head in 1690. But we can't be 100% sure, because actually the Dutch lose 10 ships in that battle, and we think we found one of them. But how we know for sure it's the Weppen van Utrecht is actually subject to some debate and discussion. But here, in the Klein Hollandia case, I'm pretty confident, 99.9% confident that this is the Klein Hollandia. It can't be anything else. And hopefully the investigations this year and going forwards for the next years corroborate that.
No, it sounds very convincing. So you've just started, you're just revisiting the site for this season at the moment, is that correct?
We did our very first dive of 2023 on the 27th of April. We tend to dive April through to about October, maybe into November, pushing it, but into October. So we have that 6 month window of investigation based on the weather, really, visibility, water temperatures. The site's at 32 meters on a low water neap, so it's a reasonably deepish dive for working at, anyway. And it's 7 miles offshore, so you've got to have the right weather. So we increase our chances of success by only diving from about April onwards. The vis wasn't great, I have to say. On the 27th, it was probably only about a metre maximum. Wasn't ideal. We've had much, much better vis in the summer months. But we got a metre maximum. And what was great is that the site's not been changed. It's not been damaged. It's not been hit. It's not been salvaged over the winter times since the announcement was made. There was a bit of a worry that we were announcing it in the January, but we're not going to be diving it till April. So that might be a problem. And also back in over the winter of 2020, so either late 2020 or early 2021, the site was trawled through. We know that the site had been impacted by a trawler over those few months because things had moved, cannons had been turned over, moved across site. Even one of the big stone blocks that must weigh more than 3 tons was moved across the site, and we could see trawl scars on it. So we were slightly worried There's always that apprehension, that first time you dive a site in a year, to how's it fared over winter, and has it been impacted in the 6 months you've not been there. But thankfully, I can report that from the dive on the 27th, it's good. It's all fine, and we're looking forward to a busy season.
Yeah, excellent. So, but is the site not protected then?
The wreck is designated by the Protection of Wrecks Act,
right?
1973, yeah. Which means, yes, it is an offence to...
So that trawler went off course then, obviously. Anyway, moving on. This is what happens, isn't it, unfortunately?
Tell me
about your plans for this season.
This year's investigation, which began on the 27th of April, runs right the way through until certainly at least September, is going to be targeted at understanding the ship construction. So we've already started that last year a little bit, and we've recovered a few samples of wood for analysis, for species identification, but also for dendrochronology. But there is masses of timber on the site. The whole of the bottom of the ship is there. We know that because we're pretty certain we've got the starboard frames and inner planking and outer planking from low down in the ship. If we just hand waft away about 20 centimetres of sand, we're at the ballast stone, so we're really low down in the ship. So it will help us work out 100% where the bow is and where the stern is, whether we really do have that starboard side. We should be able to potentially recover some of the ballast stones for analysis, geological analysis. Where did they come from? Does that help with, you know, were they ballasted up in the Netherlands and that ballast travelled with them? Or is it part of reballasting during the convoys, voyages in the Mediterranean? I'd really like to recover... just a sample, just knock off a little bit of a sample of one of the big, big stone blocks to work out whether that's also Carrara marble, because we know the smaller tiles definitely are, but it would be good to confirm that actually the big blocks, which they look, upon inspection, they look like they are, but it would be nice to know scientifically that they are also. The project's part of or the site is part of a project that's forensically marking. So that the guns will be forensically marked with a chemical material that means that if it had to be proven in to the police or in court that these were definitely from the site, then that would be possible to do. So that's taking place during this year in collaboration with the Dutch Heritage Agency, the Cultural Heritage Agency of the Netherlands, and funded with Historic England. We'll be doing that. We'll be doing lots of photogrammetry, I'm sure, on those days that the visibility is good. We've got two photogrammetry surveys that have been done, one in 21 and then one in 22. So we'll try and get another one done in 23, again, just to build up a bigger picture of what the site, and improve the site plan. I mean, I know I said at the beginning that we've done 45 visits to the site, and I myself have done 38 dives on the site over the years. Each of those dives, because of the depth, each of those dives is only about between 45 minutes maybe on the bottom to maybe 55 if you're pushing it during the good summer months when the water's warm. So realistically, I've spent less than a working week on the site. I mean, I've done less than 37 and a half hours on the wreck, which is a working week. So we're really only beginning to understand the assemblage, and different bits appear as the sands move around at different times. Sometimes it's like, oh, never seen that before. And other times that's buried in sand. And so we have to take each dive. We go in with a plan, but sometimes Mother Nature and the sands decide, actually, your plan's got to be different because you can't.
No, I mean, this is just... fascinating. It's so exciting, and I'd love to come visit myself. But is it just a Nautical Archaeology Society project? You mentioned the Dutch agencies. I mean, who else is involved, and who are the main people that are diving on the site?
The NAS became involved on that second dive in April 2019, and we reported the discovery to Historic England. It was then designated by DCMS. And I became a licensee. So I have the license to put people on the site and to do the investigation. We have a license to make recoveries of small finds that are at risk. And the assemblage is on display at Bexhill Museum, a bit further down the coast from Eastbourne, now in their exhibition. So I have a license. And then Dave, the boat skipper, also has a license. So if he wants to run a trip out to be able to put people on the site, he can as well, which is great that he's still involved, and we use him to charter the boat. So actually, economically, it's worked out as a sound thing for him to do, to report it, because actually he's then getting charters and business for him out to the site for those 45 trips so far. And the original finders are still involved as well, so that's great. So Tom and Graham, the first two divers, and amazingly, Graham is registered blind. We've got two rebreather divers, one of whom is registered blind, diving and helping us on the site, which is just phenomenal. I mean, that's like diving the site in zero vis all the time.
Yeah.
But that's the...
That's incredible.
The organisational support that we've received has been great. So we've got Historic England, of course, now as a designated site, and the Cultural Heritage Agency of the Netherlands, or RCE, for their acronym in Dutch. They've been supporting the site since 2019 as well through some grant funding. So we've had a bit of grant funding that supported a few dives in the original year, in 2019, from RCE. And then Historic England funded 3 days of diving after the trawling event that took place so that we could do the photogrammetry survey of the event and gather the evidence that was needed for a potential case for the police. So they funded that. But actually, of the 45 dives that have been done, the majority have been funded by either the society, the NES itself, through membership donations that we obviously receive, that we can then use to run investigations and to help document and protect our maritime heritage, but also by people coming and diving on the site. So we have a great core team, and then we then bolster that core team with additional divers that come in to do odd dives here and there, and they pay to come. They're willing to pay £65-70 for a dive on the site, which then helps cover the cost. So it helps cover the cost of the boat charter, so that the NES doesn't have that outlay of £750 or £800 a day for the boat charter, which is great. So we're indebted to, I think it's over 80 people now, over 80 individuals that have dived the site. Very few commercial dives, very few professional dives have taken place. The majority, which is fabulous, I love it. The majority of it is all, it's like citizen science, isn't it? I suppose is members of the public contributing knowledge, information, ideas, observations, photographs and video of the wreck for us.
That's brilliant. It really strikes at the ethos of the Nautical Archaeology Society, that inclusivity. That's fantastic. So presumably you're not excavating at this stage, or are you? Maybe you are.
No, at this stage, the only clearance of seabed that's taken place has been by hand, and has been to reveal timbers for documentation and for sampling. So that's... I don't know, what's that, about half a metre sort of at a time, just so that we can then measure it, draw it, photograph and photogrammetry, and then extract samples with hand saws. So that's, I would love to, there's, in fact, I kind of know where I would stick it, because we think we know where the centre line is, where the keelson should be.
So this is the dredge you're talking about.
It would be great to, at some point in the future, maybe along similar lines to the excavations that were done over several seasons on the Rooivijk, on the Goodwin Sands, in collaboration with the Dutch, the partnership approach between England and the Netherlands, that shared heritage approach. It would be great to think that maybe this would be a similar site in the future. But at the moment, there's still so much on the surface to document that hasn't yet been completely documented and understood, that the need for excavation is probably a few years out yet.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And so in terms of what you have found, what do you... I always like asking this question, sorry, but what's your most exciting find? Because that's the question we always get asked by non-archaeologists, so I think it's... What's clinched it for you?
That's a really tricky question, Lucy, because, I mean, the cannons are crucial for the identification. Without those on the surface, particularly the lovely ones that have got motifs on them and wording on them and weights on them and dates on them, without that, we would be struggling probably with the identification. So those have been crucial, but they're not really small finds, are they? Those are big pieces. On the small finds, I really do like, we've got a Bellarmine jug that was found by recreational divers just lying on the seabed, and it was a little wobbly, so it had been partly exposed by the sands moving, and then there was a worry that it wasn't going to be there, so they kind of lifted it up and they photographed it and videoed it, and it still had its cork inside it, and it was just a lone isolated find by itself. And at that time, we didn't have permission from Historic England to make that recovery on that dive, so they had to leave it where on the seabed, and they covered it over with some sand. And it wasn't until after a couple of weeks that we were able to go back and actually make the recovery under license. Unfortunately, in that time, the cork had gone, so the chances of knowing what was inside it or not were lost. Although I have been told that 9 times out of 10, actually, it's just seawater inside. It's leached through the cork, although the cork might still be in there. It's not that watertight seal that you would hope for. But what I do like is that the cork, the evidence that the cork was in it originally, and there is not, it's completely intact. There is not a scratch on it. I mean, literally not a scratch. Mm. So in its life, in its use on board a ship, and then in the destruction and the sinking of the ship, and then with it spending over 350 years on the seabed, and then being discovered and then recovered, there's still not a scratch on it. It's absolutely pristine, which is amazing just in terms of the processes that have impacted on this object. But also it demonstrates the real potential about what else is still and the condition that it's going to be in under the sand. Mm. We've got other white Maiolica ware, Italian ceramics with this sort of white glaze and blue decoration motif on it. And those we've seen, they're currently under sandbags, but we've seen stacks of them on each other as if they're in a box. And two, either vases or jugs with a neck and a handle, we've seen two of those on the seabed, one inside the other, one with a slightly smaller neck inside the neck of another one. Now, the ones that were on the surface that are now under sandbags were damaged. They were broken and there were bits of them. So, and we found them at the end of a season. And we were like, oh, covered them over with the sandbags. But those were just lying on the surface. And you think, well, what's underneath those? And what other crates and what other cargo were they bringing back from Italy? Because, you know, it's said that this was a very rich convoy and they were coming back from Turkey and Italy and Spain and Portugal before they left Lisbon, their final port, and coming back into the English Channel. So there's potentially a wealth of material that can really shed light on this voyage and, you know, what economic return they were hoping to make by, you know, by coming back from the Mediterranean into Holland. But, you know, obviously they never made it.
No, but to your advantage, though, by the sounds of it, it just sounds really exciting. The potential's enormous, by the, yeah, from what you're saying. Well, I mean, I'm really, really grateful to you talking to me today. It's fascinating. I may add my name to the list of people that are volunteering to come and have a look. And I wish you all the best for this season. And I think it sounds like you've just got on an amazing project for quite some years to come. And so maybe we should try and follow you around a little bit, Mark, and catch up with you occasionally to see how things are going, because it just sounds like such an exciting find.
You'd be most welcome to join us, Lucy, or any other colleagues from the HFF. We'll be diving it, I'm sure, for many, many years to come. I'm really grateful it was found when I'm in my 40s, in that I've still got probably, I don't know, 20 years of diving left, probably, on site. So, yeah, you'd be welcome to join us and follow up at a later date with new discoveries.
Oh, that's so fascinating. There's clearly so much more to be discovered on that shipwreck. I think we'll have to track Mark over the coming weeks and months to find out what new discoveries they make. Anyway, thanks so much for listening to the Dive and Dig News podcast. Hopefully we'll be back to reveal more exciting news stories to you very soon. So thank you from myself, Lucy Blue, on behalf of the Honor Frost Foundation that supports research of maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean.